The Catra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI.
Welcome back, everyone, to the deep dive. You know, this is where we try to unpack some really complex stuff, break it down so you get the core ideas without getting totally swamped.
Yeah, exactly. And today we're diving into Tibetan civilization. It's a topic often wrapped in myth, right?
Totally. Shangri-La on one hand, or, you know, just seen through a purely political lens on the other.
Precisely. So we're leaning heavily on the insights drawn from Matthew T. Kapstein's work, particularly his comprehensive book, Tibet. He's really one of the top scholars in Tibetan studies globally.
And the goal here, our mission for this deep dive, is to kind of cut through those simplistic views. Kapstein's whole approach helps us see Tibet not as some fantasy land or political football, but as this incredibly complex, dynamic, sophisticated civilization.
And crucially, understanding it on its own terms. That's key to Kapstein's approach. Okay, let's unpack this. Why is that scholarly view so much richer, so different from what most people think they know about Tibet?
Well, a lot of it comes down to Kapstein himself. His credentials, I mean, he's the Numata Professor of Buddhist Studies at UChicago, directs Tibetan Studies in Paris. He's deeply immersed in the sources.
Right. So this isn't just opinion.
Not at all. He works directly with classical Tibetan and Sanskrit texts. His scholarship is rigorous. It's dispassionate. It's not about pushing an agenda. It's about understanding how this civilization actually evolved from the inside out based on the evidence.
Got it. So not activism, but deep historical and textual analysis.
Exactly. He's presenting Tibetan civilization as it saw itself, as much as possible.
So where does Kapstein begin this story? Interestingly, it's not straight into history or religion, is it?
No, and that's fundamental to his approach. He starts with the land itself, the Tibetan Plateau. This high-altitude environment isn't just a setting. He calls it a primary force.
A primary force? How so?
Well, think about it. The sheer altitude, the geography, it dictated everything about how people lived, how they survived. It wasn't a passive backdrop. It actively shaped the culture.
Okay, give us some specifics. How did it shape lifestyles?
You immediately see the split. In the north, you have the vast Chontang, the northern plains. It's incredibly high, harsh, perfect for pastoral nomadism. So you get these resilient, mobile communities following their herds.
Right, the classic image of the Tibetan nomad.
Exactly. But then contrast that with the south in the river valleys. It's lower, warmer, relatively speaking. And there you could actually practice agriculture. So settled farming communities developed. Two very different ways of life dictated by the landscape.
And this environment, it must have shaped their worldview too, their spirituality.
Absolutely. Kapstein shows how this unique geography fostered a really deep indigenous spiritual connection to the land. The mountains, the lakes, the sky, they weren't just physical features. They were seen as sacred, powerful, inhabited by local deities, spirits, earth forces.
So an animistic view, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. A pre-Buddhist belief system that was deeply rooted in this specific place. And what's fascinating is how this didn't just disappear when Buddhism arrived later. It got woven in.
We'll definitely come back to that synthesis. But before we get to Buddhism, what about Tibet's place in the world? Was it totally isolated up there?
That's the other crucial point Kapstein makes. What's fascinating here is this geography did create a certain isolation, allowing a really unique culture to blossom. But at the same time, its location was incredibly strategic.
Strategic? Wow.
It sat right at the crossroads of major Asian powers. Think Tang Dynasty China to the east, the rising Arab Caliphate to the west, India to the south. Tibet wasn't just passively isolated. The Tibetan Empire, especially around the 7th to 9th centuries, was a major military force.
Wow. Okay, so competing with these huge empires.
Absolutely. Competing for control over vital Central Asian trade routes like the Silk Road. So it was both isolated enough for unique development and connected enough to be a significant regional player, a real paradox.
Okay, so a powerful empire shaped by its geography with a deep indigenous spiritual life. Then comes Buddhism. Here's where it gets really interesting, right? Because Kapstein argues Tibet didn't just copy Indian Buddhism.
Not at all. That's the core of his argument about this period. The genius was in creative synthesis. They took this incredibly rich tradition from India and transformed it into something uniquely Tibetan.
How did that start? Was it gradual or more of a state project?
It really kicked off during the Yarlung Empire, that period we mentioned, 7th to 9th centuries. King Sonsen Gampo is the key figure. He unified the kingdom politically and militarily, and then he initiated the formal adoption of Buddhism as a state-sponsored project.
So a top-down decision.
Very much so. And Capstein emphasizes this wasn't just about adopting a religion. They saw it as importing an entire civilization.
What did that entail? More than just prayers and monks, I assume.
Oh, much more. It meant bringing in a writing system. They adapted an Indian script to create written Tibetan. It meant importing sophisticated Indian systems of medicine, philosophy, ethics, law, art, architecture, everything.
Wow. That's a massive undertaking, a complete cultural transformation almost.
It really was. But crucially, it wasn't about replacing everything Tibetan. It was about integration. And that's where figures like Padmasambhava, or Guru Rinpo as he's known in Tibet, become so important.
Right. You mentioned him earlier in the context of the local deities.
Exactly. He's this legendary Indian tantric master who came to Tibet, and the tradition credits him with essentially taming those powerful, sometimes fierce indigenous spirits and deities of the land.
Taming them. Like defeating them.
More like converting them, binding them by oath to become protectors of the new Buddhist faith, the Dharma. It's this perfect metaphor for the synthesis process. The old powers aren't destroyed, they're incorporated and given a new role within the Buddhist framework.
So that deep-seated reverence for the land, the local spirits often called Bun or Bonpo, that indigenous tradition, it finds a place within Tibetan Buddhism.
Precisely. It gets layered in, adapted. It makes Buddhism feel authentically Tibetan, not just a foreign import. That synthesis is really the hallmark of Tibetan culture.
And this process, it wasn't simple or uniform, was it? Did it lead to different schools of thought?
Absolutely. After the initial imperial push and then the fragmentation of the empire, there was what's called the later dissemination of Buddhism. This period saw intense translation efforts, more masters coming from India, and the emergence of distinct schools.
Like the ones people might have heard of?
Yeah, the Nyingma, which traces back to Padmasambhava, the Kagyu, known for its yogic traditions, the Sakya, associated with scholarship and, for a time, political rule, and later, the Gelug school, the school of the Dalai Lamas.
So a lot of internal diversity, intellectual debate.
Huge vibrancy. This wasn't some monolithic, unchanging thing. It was a dynamic, intellectual, and spiritual landscape with different lineages, different philosophical emphases, competing for influence and patronage. Really sophisticated stuff.
Which leads us neatly into how this religious landscape eventually shaped the political structure, the unique Tibetan theocracy, the Ganden Phodrang government. How did that come about?
It's the culmination of this long process of integrating religion and society. It really takes shape with the rise of the Gelug school, founded by the great reformer Tsongkhapa in the 14th, 15th century.
And they had a particular innovation for leadership, didn't they? The reincarnate lamas.
Yes, the Tulku system. While it existed earlier in other schools, the Gelugs really systematized and utilized it politically. The idea of identifying the reincarnation of a deceased High Lama provided a non-hereditary way to ensure leadership succession.
That's actually kind of brilliant politically. It avoids the succession crises that plagued so many other kingdoms based on bloodlines.
Exactly. It created, in theory, a stable, continuous line of ideological and spiritual leadership embodied in these reincarnate figures, believed to be choosing to return to guide others.
And the most famous example of this, of course, is the Dalai Lama lineage.
Right. And the pivotal moment comes with the fifth Dalai Lama, Ngawang Lobsang Gyatso, often called the Great Fifth in the 17th century. He was a brilliant strategist and spiritual figure.
What did he achieve?
With the military backing of a Mongol leader, Gushri Khan, he managed to unify Tibet under his authority, overcoming rival schools and secular rulers. He then established the formal government known as the Ganden Phodrang.
Based in the Potala Palace in Lhasa, which he largely built.
That's right. And this is where the political theory gets really unique, as Capstein lays it out. The Tibetan state, under the Ganden Phodrang, wasn't just a kingdom ruled by a powerful lama. It was conceived, theoretically, as an estate belonging to Avalokiteshvara.
The Bodhisattva of compassion.
Yes. And the Dalai Lama was believed to be the human embodiment, the manifestation of Avalokiteshvara on Earth.
So, the state itself has a kind of divine owner, and the ruler is the embodiment of compassion governing it.
That's the core concept. It means that governing, dealing with administration, law, even defense, all the mundane tasks of running a state were framed as a sacred mission, an expression of compassionate activity for the benefit of all beings.
Okay, but hang on. You mentioned Mongol military backing Gushri Khan. How does this idealistic theory of compassionate rule square with the, well, the real politic, the necessary force used to establish and maintain power?
That's a crucial tension, Capstein explores. The spiritual mandate, The idea of Avalokiteshvara as a state provided the ultimate legitimacy. It was the source of authority within Tibet. The external military force was, you could say, the tool used to secure the conditions for that legitimate rule.
So the theory provided the why, the justification, and the power politics provided the how.
In a way, yes. The sacred ideology gave the Ganden Phodrong its internal coherence and authority, even if its establishment involved alliances in force. And this structure permeated society.
How so? What about the social structure under this system?
Monasteries were absolutely central. They weren't just places for monks to study and meditate. They were huge institutions.
In what sense?
They were major landowners controlling vast agricultural estates. They were centers of economic activity, crafts, trade. They were the primary providers of education, so, not just religious, but also literacy, arts, medicine. Mm-hmm. They were like administrative hubs.
So the monasteries formed the backbone of the whole pre-modern Tibetan society, economically, culturally, administratively.
Absolutely. The entire social fabric was interwoven with this monastic system, which was itself integrated into the Ganden Phodrang state, headed by the Dalai Lama. Really profound symbiosis.
Okay, so we have this unique civilization, deeply shaped by its land, creatively synthesizing Buddhism, and developing this intricate theocratic state centered on compassion. But then, moving into the modern era, this centuries-long trajectory faces, well, a massive break.
A rupture, as Capstein puts it. A rupture with a millennium of historical and cultural evolution. We have to talk about the 19th and 20th centuries, increasing geopolitical pressure from Britain, China, Russia.
The Great Game era.
Right. Which eventually led to the Chinese invasion in 1950, and then the really traumatic events of the 1959 uprising in Lhasa.
Which resulted in the flight of the current Dalai Lama, the 14th, into exile in India, along with tens of thousands of Tibetans.
Yes. And the subsequent period, especially the Cultural Revolution in the 60s and 70s, saw devastating destruction of monasteries, religious texts, cultural artifacts. Capstein is very clear about the scale of this loss, this assault on the traditional way of life.
A truly tragic period. But Capstein's narrative doesn't end there, does it? He balances the destruction with something else.
He does. He highlights the extraordinary resilience of Tibetan culture and identity. It's almost a counter-narrative to the story of loss.
How does this resilience manifest?
It's really a two-part story running in parallel. First, inside Tibet itself, despite decades of political control and suppression, there's this tenacious effort by ordinary Tibetans to maintain their language, their religious practices, their cultural identity, often in subtle ways, under difficult circumstances.
Holding on to their roots.
Exactly. And then you have the second part. The remarkable story of the Tibetan diaspora, the exile community.
Led by the Dalai Lama, what did they manage to achieve?
It's quite incredible, really. They didn't just survive. They actively preserved and even revitalized core aspects of their civilization in exile. They established monasteries, schools, cultural institutes, primarily in India, but also globally.
And more than just preserved, didn't they also adapt and spread Tibetan Buddhism?
Massively. The 14th Dalai Lama in particular became this global figure. Tibetan Buddhism, especially its philosophy, its meditation techniques, its emphasis on compassion, found a huge audience worldwide. It transformed from a relatively isolated tradition into a global religion.
So they used education, media, the Dalai Lama's charisma, strategic adaptation.
Absolutely. And Capstein presents this as a powerful lesson in cultural resilience. Mm-hmm. How does a community respond when its homeland, its institutions, its very way of life are shattered? The Tibetan exile experience, how they organized, educated, adapted their message, engaged with the world, offers a really compelling case study.
A model, perhaps, for other threatened cultures in our globalized age.
It certainly provides a lot to think about in terms of cultural survival strategies.
Okay, so if we try to pull all these threads together from Capstein's work, what's the big picture, the final takeaway?
I think the main insight is that his work gives us an authoritative corrective. It moves us beyond those simple, often misleading images, the fantasy Shangri-La, or the purely political victim narrative.
And replaces it with what?
With a multidimensional reality. A picture of a civilization with immense historical depth, shaped by a unique environment, capable of profound intellectual and spiritual innovation, that built a unique political system, and that has shown incredible resilience in the face of modern trauma. It's about appreciating the complexity and the enduring human creativity.
A much richer, more nuanced understanding.
Definitely. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Capstein's analysis implicitly raises fascinating questions for all of us, I think. Well, the whole Tibetan model, especially the Ganden Phodrang idea, a state explicitly centered on an ethical principle like compassion, integrating spiritual values directly into governance, it stands as a really interesting, almost provocative alternative to the dominant modern model of the secular nation state.
It's not necessarily about saying one is better, but that other models have existed and might offer different perspectives.
Exactly. It prompts reflection. What is the role of ethics, of values in public life and political structures? Tibet, for centuries, tried to build its system around wisdom and compassion. Kapstein doesn't romanticize him. He shows the complexities, the tensions, the historical realities.
But the ideal itself is worth considering.
Precisely. The ultimate lesson maybe isn't about finding a lost utopia, but about thinking critically about political organization. How does a society try to establish and maintain stable leadership focused on something beyond just power or wealth? Tibet's answer, with the Tolku system and the Avalokiteshvara concept, was one unique attempt.
So the final thought for you, the listener, might be, what universal lessons, if any, can we draw from a civilization that, for all its historical complexities and struggles, genuinely attempted to place wisdom and compassion at the very heart of its society and government?
It's a challenging legacy, and Kapstein's work gives us the detailed, nuanced understanding we need to even begin grappling with that question.
A truly deep dive into a fascinating civilization.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.